Welcome to Fed OSS with Fed Scoop's Luke Fretwell and Red Hat's Gunnar Hellickson. In this episode, Development Seed's David Cole discusses CMS-free websites, including Jekyll Pros and GitHub, and how the new healthcare.gov will leverage these technologies. Also, how open source will bring world peace.
So what's your take on our interview with Dave?
That was great. I thought, you know, I'm really excited. What's cool about it is, so first of all, open source through and through. So, you know, I love it for that reason, right? You know, we've got open source tools being used. The content is open source, and actually they're going through it in a, and like you were saying, both the technology and the philosophy, right, which is fantastic. So that gets me excited. I love the idea that they're building it from the ground up to be shared with the states. That's super cool. And I like the idea, too, that it's such a they kind of took a step back from the problem, and rather than using all the usual tools that you might expect to be using, they actually said, well, what is it that we are trying to do here? And found a solution that was like literally 30 times easier than what they had done for, as an example, what they had done for whitehouse.gov. It's great. And I'm super excited about it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too. It's not just, you know, some sort of external open source guru guy coming in who has no experience in this stuff. You know, Dave was in the midst of, you know, the new whitehouse.gov launching, you know, and like he mentions in the interview, it, you know, working with the Presidential Innovation Fellows and how they deployed all of this. You know, there's some experience and understanding large-scale content management websites at the government, you know, at the federal level, but also, you know, this experimental stuff that's happening with the Innovation Fellows and how they deployed it. And you know, Brian Sack is, you know, obviously a big proponent of pushing out open source and sharing that, and he's done that a lot. And it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward, especially that, you know, as the states start to figure out this stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else? What else happened this week? Or what else is, you know, of interest to you that we should be taking a look at? I know for me, I had pinged you on China and the China government adopting Ubuntu as an operating system. And, you know, the conspiracy theorist in me, I was giving you a hard time. You know, we've got Red Hat. We've got this whole social coding going on, and now China's adopting this open source stuff. You know, Joe McCarthy is probably turning in his grave.
Right. Well, no, I think that, so first of all, skipping over the fact that China has decided to, or this one ministry in China, we should say, is using a competitor. It's not like overnight they're going to, you know, take 1.2 billion people and flip them over to Ubuntu, right? This one ministry decided that they were going to standardize on Ubuntu, and good for them. I think what's really interesting, though, is this is the question of security, right? Like you were saying, you know, conspiracy theorists, like, oh, great, now China's mucking around in the Ubuntu system, so now what? No, Linux isn't secure anymore, you know? I think this is actually an example of the system, potentially this is an example of the system working, right? If it was a proprietary piece of software. So, you know, what a lot of people don't remember or realize is that when China uses it, everyone knows that China is, you know, we're trying to hack China, China's trying to hack us, right? That's there's no secret there. When a piece of proprietary software goes on sale in China, the Chinese government insists on seeing the source code for it, right? And it's presumably for security reasons, but really, you know, but they can use it for all kinds of reasons, right? So this idea that just because the code is open, it's going to somehow make it more or less secure when it gets in the hands of the Chinese government, is just a little bit silly, right? And in fact, thank God the code is open source, so that if somebody makes a change that puts other people at a disadvantage, then we can do something about it, right? You know, if there was a change that we didn't like in a piece of proprietary code, there's we may never even know that it's there, right? So again, openness, transparency is good for security. So yeah, hopefully, my hope is that you know, if the Chinese ministry wants folks to use Ubuntu, that's going to end up with you know, more features and security fixes in the Linux kernel, which everyone benefits from.
Yeah, open source could lead to world peace.
Open source for world peace. That's the title of the episode, man. That's exactly right.
So before we get in with Dave, the only other thing I'm curious about is the awards nominations for Open Source for America closed today?
Yeah, today. Well, anyway, by the time somebody listens to this, they will be closed. That's right.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, have you had a chance to look at them? Are we nominated for Best Open Source Podcast?
I have. Well, first of all, we've already won Best Open Source Podcast.
Oh, there you go.
In my own mind. But the no, I haven't had a chance to look at the nominations yet. Although this is a good time to mention, though, that we actually have new leadership over at Open Source for America. So a big congratulations to Deb Bryant and Kane McLean, who have been members for quite a long time, have been kind of actively involved in the organization, and are now co-chairs. So congratulations, guys. Nice work.
Oh, nice.
He said as I lean back in my lounge chair and sip a pina colada now that I'm no longer responsible for the organization.
I'm sure that's not going to be the case. we'll have to have them on and talk about, you know, what their plans are going forward.
And, well, that's a great idea. Yeah, we should.
What's the process, next step for the awards?
So the nominations are in. You know what? You caught me off guard. I don't remember what the process is, but I'm fairly certain if you go to the website, it's all documented up there. So if you guys are interested in the awards or when the announced dates are, like I say, I'm pretty sure that's on the Open Source for America website.
Okay, and that's opensourceforamerica.org.
Yep, you got it.
Okay, great. Well, as always, it's a pleasure talking with you. It's a great way to end the week.
Yeah. Exactly. Thanks, Luke.
Well, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Dave, you were part of the first time I saw you was actually you and Macon Phillips were doing an acceptance speech via video for the Open Source for America Awards. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
So you were part of that. On that note, you were part of the team that worked on the administration's, the new WhiteHouse.gov that was built in Drupal in 2008. And can you talk a little about your role there, what you did? I know you did a number of different things, and I know that it's influenced your thoughts on content management systems, especially as it relates to large-scale government websites.
Yeah, sure. So the first thing we wanted to do was actually during the transition team, right after the election was finished, we started redesigning WhiteHouse.gov. We didn't have any idea what the technology structure would be or really anything other than we wanted a completely new brand and look on the website, and we were going to generate some new content that we wanted to feature. Some of the content stayed. For instance, it's a very popular site with students. There's a lot of historic information about previous presidents, about the White House, about some information about the structure of government generally. So we kind of took an editing path with that, just made sure that everything was up to date, and you know, added in new bios where necessary, and then did a whole rebrand. That actually launched at noon during President Obama's inauguration. So right on the dot, we had that site up. And we worked with the existing technology team at the White House. They were very helpful to let us you know, give them designs, work with them on content, and basically get everything ready to go so that we could pull that off on time. That was our first big project. The next thing, pretty soon after we got into the White House, we realized is that we didn't have the flexibility we were used to working with in the website. You know, the system was designed for people who generally wanted to be entering content, but not do very much more with the actual presentation or add new features. So it's kind of a typical, you know, contract where you buy a particular product and then there's a maintenance period. And at the time we got there, we were automatically in the maintenance period when we really wanted to be starting the first sprint of our agile development cycle. We wanted each new, you know, month to bring another feature or another development or in some way enhance the way we were using the website to communicate with the American people. So we started looking at new options. We settled on using Drupal as the backend system a couple months in, and we basically began a long process to alter some of the structure of the contract to give us the flexibility to bring in new Drupal talent. You know, this was a technology that the current contract we were working with had not used in the past, but they were open to learning. So we brought in a couple shops to help us who were experts in that field, and we basically designed from scratch the whole backend system behind the new front end that we put together. We did a design refresh too, just to kind of keep things up to date, but that was it. And it was largely driven by, you know, the content owners needing to have more control of their website. They needed to be able to, you know, present the president's message in whatever way was going to resonate, whether that was tighter social media integration or new features such as RSS feeds or better search, you know, faceted search. You know, those kind of features drove the need for better technology.
Right. So fast forward to 2013, you guys are working, you're now working with the Department of Health and Human Services on healthcare.gov. And I know you've written a lot about this, and we're starting to hear a little bit more about it. Jekyll Pros and GitHub and how they work together. And, you know, Gunnar and I have joked a little bit about this, but, you know, the web started out with these static pages of thousands of HTML files. And, you know, now we're at this content management phase. And now you're advocating a CMS-free static websites again. Can you give an overview of how Jekyll and Prose and GitHub tie in together and how you're deploying all this for the new healthcare.gov?
Right, and now for something completely different. It's basically taking you know, what we were doing and trying to do it a little smarter previous to CMS. So the general idea here, there are two parts. There's a philosophical part and then there's the technology part. And the two aren't necessarily always linked together. I think the philosophy is actually much more sound, and the technology still has a lot of development to get us to the point where you know, we really need it to be. So the general idea here is when you were generating static sites, you were basically doing exactly what browsers, you know, expected. When people load up a web page, they get the content that web page needs. It's in HTML, JavaScript, CSS. It's the basic building blocks to present the website, and the browser knows what to do with that. Behind the scenes, what a CMS is doing is actually a complex process to generate that page for you. And maybe that includes pulling in a list of most popular content or sorting content based on chronology and adding in metadata for related content, right? It's doing some sort of dynamic processing in real time to give you the content that, you know, the user has requested. What we're talking about doing now is actually saying that all that processing that needs to happen, it is really good. The stuff that CMSs have given us has been really helpful in creating better experiences for people using the web. But it doesn't need to happen on read when a user requests a web page. It should actually be happening on write when a content creator generates the web page. Right. So it's kind of flipping the model.
So what are the advantages to that model? I mean, I guess I get the idea of basically instead of regenerating the page brand new every single time, just doing it once kind of, I guess, intuitively makes sense because it would be simpler. But how does it improve maybe the user experience or how does it improve your kind of operational experience?
Yeah, so the first part in the process, it makes it a lot easier to build these sites. You know, we immediately start jumping in just working on HTML templates, and then we work on, you know, the design strategy for how we want to present content and allow people to engage with it. There's no time spent on configuring databases or installing PHP applications on top of web servers. And, you know, the real benefit then to users is actually that the content is very reliable and very scalable. When you generate a package of static HTML files and put it on a server to serve, the server has to do the bare minimum amount of work it takes to distribute that content. When you build a CMS and install that on a server, there's actually a lot more processing power. And in order to scale that, what you need to do is essentially add more servers or add a layer of caching on top of your servers that basically takes the content and temporarily stores it in memory. You get into more complex configurations. So, you know, just generally, it's a lot simpler.
So what made you choose this particular combination of tools? I mean, we could go back at, like Luke and I were joking earlier, you could go all the way back to movable type, right? back in the early days. Or, you know, kind of handcraft these, you know, do all these pages by hand, I suppose. Why Jekyll, why Prose, and why GitHub?
Yeah, so at the time I left the White House around March in 2011, it was very interesting for CMSs generally. We were specifically involved in the Drupal community, and the company I ended up joining was called Development Seed. They were also very active in the Drupal community up until this point, and they had basically stopped making Drupal sites as well for a lot of these same reasons, right? And what we kind of did at that point when I was joining forces with them is start to think again about the most basic components that we need, right? Really just go for extreme simplicity. Let's just write our next client project completely in HTML, JavaScript, and CSS. Let's not have any backend server at all. And we'll just put that page up on Amazon S3, right, which is a very simple file server that's incredibly scalable. Mm-hmm. So then we start to say, okay, what are we missing here? Well, we really need to have some way to template so we can get beyond one page, right? We need to have 10 pages, and they all need to have the same header and footer or some other elements, right? So when we start looking for other tools that patch in those specific requirements, maybe it's commenting, maybe it's, as I mentioned, sorting content by popularity, take those dynamic features and piece them in as you need them. This is in marked change, new direction from what I think CMSs have been getting to at this point, which is to try to do everything with one application. The same application that manages your content also manages users' access to that content, and it manages serving that content to the public generally, and it manages all kinds of other elements of presentation and functionality. And maybe you throw search in there. You know, people might actually be storing data for data applications in there as well that has nothing to do with content. It's just kind of a feature of the content. And you get very complex systems that do a lot, but if one thing breaks, the whole thing kind of falls apart. That's a lot of where we were coming from, was getting away from those monolithic systems. This also coincided with the seventh release of Drupal 7, which that had taken a very specific direction to try to offer more for users out of the box. But at the end, when you try to offer more, sometimes you actually do worse with the core features that you need. So specifically to the technology we're using now, Jekyll is an open source project that started at GitHub, and it's basically a way that you can write your content in a text file and write your templates out in some markups that you would usually use, very similar to if you're writing templates for a CMS. And then you basically run Jekyll, and it takes the content, inserts it into the templates, and renders your HTML. So it's incredibly simple. And it's fast, and it allows us to get output of a website, the HTML and other assets that we can just put on a very simple web server. It also integrates very well with GitHub, which is important because GitHub is a really integral part to an agile workflow. Or using GitHub as the public service or Git internally, the idea that you keep all of your code and now also all of your content under version control makes it very easy to track progress and avoid bugs and regressions that come up, and really just have a lot of transparency in the development process. So
does that mean you have to, for your content, your content contributor, right? Whatever your marketing person or basically not a programmer, right? What is their experience of using this? Do you need to teach them how to use Git and make sure they're all branching before they merge the stuff back in, or how does it work?
Yeah, exactly. So that's where we started, right? Jekyll's tagline is blogging for hackers. It's designed mm-hmm. specifically for people who are very comfortable with text files and the command line. So we've introduced a new product that's actually another open source service that anybody can use publicly, and it sits on top of this. It's called Prose, and it's basically your CMS interface for creating Jekyll content. So when you go into Prose and you create a new post for your website, it looks just like a CMS. You've got a text field, you've got options for metadata, you hit save. And what that does is it actually takes the content that you've just created and it writes the text file for you and commits it over to GitHub through their API. So it's a very seamless process. Your site updates, as soon as that site regenerates, in a matter of seconds usually for most sites. And you've had no other backend system except for GitHub, as kind of the data management system.
So what happens when GitHub goes away, right? That's one of the concerns I know with having these systems that aren't installed locally, right? People love to hug their servers. So say a tool like Prose or GitHub, right? Because you're almost inextricably tied to GitHub. How do you ensure that that everything will be safe, even if some of these services might go away?
Yeah, so here's the really neat difference. With this kind of approach, you're only tied to GitHub or any server side component for editing content, not for serving content. if your traditional CMS goes away, generally that means your website is offline, in addition to being unable to edit content. And there's a different level of severity, I think, that goes with those two. If there's a 404 on the homepage, mm-hmm. it's a much bigger issue than if it's going to take you a half hour to an hour to be able to put a new blog post up. So by generating these static files, you know, what we do on a site like healthcare.gov, for instance, you know, what we will do is actually host that actual content completely in some sort of cloud computing environment. So we may use Akamai NetStorage, right, which is a very simple file store, or S3, which is Amazon's similar, though not equivalent, but can be used for the same kind of service.
Mm-hmm. Huh, interesting. So knowing what you know now, were there any trade-offs that you wish you didn't have to make? Is there anything that you wish were different about how the system works today?
It's an interesting detox process, right? You immediately start thinking.
especially from a Drupal developer, right?
Right. So the kind of the line in Drupal is there's a module for that, right? Anytime you need to plug in a new piece of functionality, someone's probably already written it, which is actually really good if you're just trying to bootstrap a project and get going. In this kind of environment, there is not necessarily as much pre-written, but because the barrier to entry is a lot simpler, you can create your own services much quicker. You know, for the healthcare.gov project, we probably have written now two or three very small plugins that add additional features to Jekyll. But we don't have to worry about making them incredibly scalable because they're only going to run when you regenerate your site, when you save new content, not like a Drupal plugin, for instance, has to run every time the site is viewed. So again, by shifting everything to that write operation, you kind of completely change the framework in which you work. So it's much easier to develop. In terms of new features, though, PROS is really, I think, the future of this approach for where we need to do more development. There's a very basic version of PROS up. It works really well for blogs. We use it for a lot of internal projects. The next version of PROS that we're working on right now, we're going to try to time with the release of healthcare.gov in June. And that's going to be a much better interface, strictly trying to be the writer's window on GitHub, right? It's the way writers can interact with GitHub without needing command line or much knowledge of code. And it's going to be very limited to content creation and editing. I think this is going to be really neat for making this more accessible. There's a ton of backlog that we could do to make PROS reach the feature-level parity with CMSs. This is at the beginning where I kind of made the distinction between the philosophy and the technology. All of this is on the technology side. There's always more to build there. But the philosophy is what really drives this, which is to say, let's move all of the major operations that we can on the right, at the right time, and not at the read time. And so when we develop with that in mind, it opens up, you know, basically the possibility to get to all the other features we had before in a, you know, faster and more scalable way.
So, and did I read this right, that you folks had, that you got your, at one point, this was running on, I'm trying to remember the number, 30 servers, and now it's only running on one server? Did I hear that? Is that the right statistic?
Yeah, so there basically was a proof of concept of a new healthcare.gov, and it was going to use, and maybe I should just give a quick background here on what this project is. In June, mm-hmm. we're going to redesign a new healthcare.gov. It's being driven by Health and Human Services Department, and basically coming online this fall will be healthcare exchanges, which are marketplaces where people can go directly to a government website and shop for healthcare. All the people shopping for healthcare will be pooled together, so you get kind of a group buying rate, which is what you get if you work for a company that provides you with insurance, but it'll be made available to the general public. So in order to prepare for this, we're setting up a lot of new web technology. And the first part is a redesign on healthcare.gov with a ton of new content that explains very simply for, you know, everybody out there, depending on no matter which group they're coming from or what their circumstances are, explains to them what to expect for the new healthcare site. So in June, we have a release of the new front end of that site. This is all the Jekyll and PROS work that we're talking about now. And then in October, there'll be a follow-up, which is when the actual dynamic marketplace comes online. So that's kind of the general background for what we're doing with healthcare.gov. The proof of concept that had been put together initially for what this new healthcare.gov would look like in June used an existing CMS that HHS uses for many different sites. And it's kind of similar to how Drupal or others would work. It's a little less nimble, but it requires a server for editing and then a server for the database. And then if you want to have the content available to the web, you probably want to add in a few different servers that will receive requests and generate the pages. And, you know, if you're talking about a site at the scale, suddenly you end up with, you know, 10 servers, and then you want to have that in your staging and your production and your development environment. So you've got three different environments, and now you're at 30. And then there were two other servers in for auxiliary services. So it was about 32 was the initial concept that was actually built as a proof of concept for what this would look like. Because it's June, we're coming in very late to the game. This project has started a while ago. But what we were able to do working with the team there is say, hey, if you think about this a little differently, if you think about creating the content when you write the content as opposed to when you read it, you can eliminate that whole first stack of servers, right? All those web servers just go away, and what you'll do is you'll take your content and just push it directly out to the CDN that you were already going to use anyway, the Akamai content distribution network in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go back and say, okay, well, if we're using GitHub as our back-end code management system, it already has branching and versioning built in for the developers, right? The content editors still need to worry about this. But then you can eliminate the need for three different environments. So now you've first vertically and then horizontally collapsed your infrastructure, and you get down to a point where you're really looking at two servers. You're looking at a GitHub server, which can be the publicly hosted GitHub.com site, or an internal GitHub instance, which you can go to GitHub's website and download and pay a licensing fee to run behind your firewall. And then one server to actually regenerate the Jekyll site for you. So it's and that server just rsyncs the content up to the CDN, and you know it can serve for this purpose basically an infinite amount of traffic without really needing to scale any additional resources.
And that's so cool. That's so cool. Is this something that other agencies, presumably this is something that other agencies could take advantage of? If there's a CIO listening to this and they're saying, oh, I wish I could use this on my website because I like one server more than 30 servers. I mean, that's pretty compelling, right? Is this more appropriate for one type of website over another?
Yeah, I think it's more appropriate for a content site over an application site, right? So if you think about the White House site, for instance, there's the main whitehouse.gov, which is most of the content, the blog, the videos and photos. It's really good for that kind of thing. There's another part of whitehouse.gov, which is the petitions application, We the People. And this is less suited for that because that's really about users creating content. But the two work really well together, because what this forces you to do is not try to build We the People into your content system, which if you're working on Drupal might seem like a good idea because you technically can do it, but you probably should think of We the People as a separate application and design something tailored specifically for that purpose rather than think about a system designed for managing content and try to figure out how that can handle dynamic user-generated content, right? They're two different use cases.
Right. Let each one succeed at what it's going to be good at, rather than making one thing take over the job for everybody.
Exactly. And the prolific, the fact that most services now are offering machine readable access to their data through APIs makes this really easy to do. For instance, one of the popular things you do with Drupal is you have a module that takes images and resizes it for you. And that's server side processing. So in our case, we still need that because we want to have a thumbnail next to the blog post, but then a full picture when you load the full post. We just use Flickr. So we upload all of our images to Flickr, and we use Flickr's API to pull those images back into our website when a user views it. So we can handle the same kind of functionality that we would have depended on building something custom for, just using external services. We use the same for using Discuss for comments or Twitter. Integration on our blog is actually more popular generally, we have our own service, mapbox.com, which is using the same philosophy, providing you an API for map-based content.
Well, that's great. So so obviously some of these tools exist out in the public. There's nothing really special about them, government-wise, right? So there's Jekyll is already out there, GitHub is already out there. Is all the tooling kind of available to the agencies? So again, this interested CIO, can they just go to GitHub and download everything they need and get going? Or should they talk to Development Seed, or how does it work?
Yeah, so to your earlier question about reusability. So this is actually a lot of what we're going to be able to release is coming from, I think, just really solid leadership from the HHS team, specifically the CTO over there, Brian Civic, who is taking an open by default approach. And that team is basically saying, what we want to do is not only release a website, but we want to release all the parts that make that website work really well as open source packages, not as a whole CMS, right? This isn't a one-size-fits-all thing, but take each of the discrete things it needs to do and make them their own open source packages that you can plug and play depending on what you need to do. So concretely, Prose is an open source application and it's hosted, so you can use it for free, or you can download it and use it on your own servers. And HHS is essentially sponsoring a whole other round of prose development, which is going to bring it to a much more functional level than it is currently. That immediately will be available for anybody in the public, including government agencies, to take advantage of. There's a bunch of Jekyll modules that we put together, right? So one of the things Jekyll does by default is sort all of your content in reverse chronology, just like a blog. Well, for the healthcare site, it's very important actually to be able to sort content by popularity, you know, so people can see what content is actually being read by others, especially when it's a very new concept. So we put together a simple Jekyll module, which when you generate your site, queries Google Analytics API, gets a list of all the URLs of your posts and all the view counts, and then adds that to Jekyll as metadata so that you can resort. So this module is going to be released probably even before the June release of the site, and anybody can use that. And now you have a new feature that made Jekyll a little bit closer to that dynamic element that people are looking for in a CMS. So, you know, we're going to keep releasing each component as we can in an open source repository on GitHub, and just, you know, let other people both use and contribute. The other idea here, too, is that the entire site should be open source. And the reason for this is that part of health reform is that the government, the federal government, will provide a health exchange, but states also have the option, should they choose, to set up their own exchanges. Maybe for economic reasons, it makes more sense for people to shop around amongst the state rather than in a national pool. So by having the code available, states could take this actual full site and the plugins that we put together and customize it or use it for their own data in their own marketplace.
That's fantastic. So does that mean that if I find a spelling mistake on healthcare.gov, I can send you a pull request?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Totally awesome. God, that's great.
I've seen a lot of that following the We the People. People have been correcting spelling.
Yeah, and why not? You know, you've got a lot of people who are interested in this. And what's more frustrating than seeing a government, or even, you know, whether it's a commercial system, a bank or something, and there's just some problem, right? Maybe a feature's just not working the way it should, or so there's an obvious usability error, especially if you're more technical, and you have absolutely no feedback loop to fix it. You know, maybe there's a button that'll say, you know, leave a feedback report, and that'll go into a black box that somebody may or may not read. But in this case, you can actually look at the code, and if you know enough about code to know what's wrong, you can fix it, or you can just file an issue and say, hey, this isn't working. And, you know, the people who are actually maintaining the system will be able to review and get back to you, and you'll see the progress happen in the follow-up right there in an open repository.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So tell me about, now this is all government stuff, right? So tell me about how did you deal with section 508, you know, accessibility rules, if you went through a security, if you've gone through your CNA, your security review, what was that like? I'm trying to imagine, you know, kind of explaining this to a security officer might be a little bit difficult because it doesn't really work like your normal web-based, you know, content management system, right?
Yeah. So Section 508, we feel is incredibly important just generally as an accessibility standard. I know it's sometimes can be seen as the bane of a developer's existence because some of the rules are, they're a bit esoteric and they are not immediately obvious why they're important. But, you know, if you take 508 at what it's designed to do, it is actually really important. And it's also a philosophy that developers should adopt, which is you should design content to be accessible to everyone, not just to people using, you know, a browser with visual facilities. So what we're able to do with 508 here is essentially have total control over the layout of the site. We don't have any modules in this system that contribute markup or design to the site. Usually, you know, if you plug in the blog module in Drupal, that comes with a whole host of HTML markup and CSS styling that you can override, but then you get into a situation of, you know, overrides on top of overrides, and things like 508 remediation for alternate tags or color contrast becomes much harder because you're trying to figure out where did this code even originate. Having a flat architecture like this makes it very easy to find where the code originates and make remediations. So we're developing with 508 tester in tandem with the process, and we're testing, you know, as we go. We did a review just yesterday and found four or five things that could be fixed, and they were fixed by that afternoon. So it makes it a much less painful process. As for security, we're piggybacking off of existing systems here, right? We're going to actually serve the site out of a bucket on NetStorage, and Akamai and NetStorage have already been reviewed and approved because they're used on many government websites generally, and specifically HHS is using it. So by doing this, the only thing that really needs to be reviewed from a public access standpoint are the raw HTML JavaScript files that we're producing. It's a very easy review. Internally, you know, the network that's producing this is completely firewalled off. The only thing that has access is, you know, that one server that has the files needs access to write them up to Akamai, but no, there's no public reading on that server. Or no public writing, rather. So nobody's actually contributing to data to that specific server. So the firewall rules can really take care of a lot of the security requirements. I'm not sure specifically what's going on in this CNA, but I know that, you know, as I mentioned, Akamai's being reviewed, and people are going to do like an application review of Jekyll the same as you would a desktop application, because it essentially sits on an internal computer. And that's very easy to do, too, because Jekyll is also open source and in GitHub, and you know, someone can actually just read line by line the code, which is much harder to do with something that's closed and compiled.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great.
So, Dave, we had talked about this earlier this week, but, you know, you've got healthcare.gov. All the code is up there. It's available to be downloaded and repurposed. And I know you had mentioned to me that this is a great opportunity for the states to completely repurpose this. Can you talk a little bit about how that would work?
Yeah, I think it's 8 or so states, I'm not sure the final number here, are opting basically to run their own health exchanges. So if you go to healthcare.gov and you try to sign up for a plan, you'll basically be bumped over and say you live in this state and that state provides its own exchange.
Right.
It'll take you over there and they'll have their own rules and their own infrastructure. Basically, each of those states, and it could be up to 50 if they all wanted to do it, would have to design their own systems and build their own systems, procure their own technology. What we're trying to do is short-circuit that a bit by getting our code out there as soon as we can. You know, at least the content about what health reform is and how the health exchanges work, we want to get out there, right? The back-end database system that manages reports is a completely different, you know, traditional IT system. It's a little less portable. But the content about the site and the whole front-end experience of the site is absolutely portable. So we're putting the code available and the content available in GitHub for people to just download and fork and edit on their own. But we're also building in our own API. So healthcare.gov will have a content API. It's a trend that I think is taking off in government, especially with some support from the recent digital strategy released by the CIO's office. And basically the idea is that if content is available to humans to read through web pages, it should also be machine readable through some sort of API. And this has just been kind of a phenomenal development and externality for us, because on one hand, if you're listing a, if you're publishing a very specific definition of, say, the CHIP program, and you want to have that definition standardized across all the states and maybe even commercial insurance partners about how the government defines that program, you can actually have each of those websites request from healthcare.gov an API request to get that definition and then insert it into their web pages. If there's a change made at the federal level, that can be very simply propagated to all the other properties. It just becomes a really great way to link content and keep things in sync. And when you have such a complex project like this, that's often going to be usable. So that's kind of the public side of the API. Developers can take it and develop new interfaces, new applications with it as well. What we've
that's
been
a,
able to,
sorry to interrupt, Dave. That's really, really cool. It's just like it reminds me very much of what they did with the Federal Register, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Like, in case anybody listening to this thinks that that sounds like crazy and impractical and like a bunch of programmers running amok, that is exactly how the Federal Register works today.
Yeah, I think absolutely this is going to be a way that new sites are built, and it really comes from watching, you know, a lot of development at, you know, tech-specific companies. If you look in Silicon Valley or in New York or, you know, even our company at Mapbox, we design our API first, and the website that the public uses is an interface on that API. And, you know, the process is called dog fooding, right? Eating your own dog food here to make sure that your API will work well because you built your whole application around it. So as I was about to mention for healthcare.gov, what this means is traditionally for a website, you're going to have a, you know, listing of content. You're going to have search, a couple filters on search for faceting. And then there's other ways to do it too, like a structured kind of wizard-like experience where you step through answering questions in order, and based on those questions, a selection of content is presented to you. Well, we don't have to build a whole server-side application to do that if all of our content is available as an API. What we can do is just build a simple web page that, you know, stores a couple of your responses just in your own browser. It never even hits our servers, and then queries the API with that data and produces the list back to the user. So you get a search results page based on this structured process without having to have any extra overhead or complexity involved.
That's amazing, especially as someone who, you know, is in the content business and knowing how government works on content. to be able to repurpose that for the States, would save a ton of resources. I can't even imagine.
And keeping it in the open makes possible for the opportunity for states to make things even better too, right? If they're using the code or using the API and come up with a better interface, we can roll that back in or share it with other properties.
Yeah, no, that's a great pattern actually that we've seen. I've seen many times, right, where what I tell, like when I talk to folks at the state level, and actually at the federal level too, that anytime you see a federal mandate rolling down to states, there is an opportunity for an open source solution, right? Because the if the federal government is telling a state what to do, then there are 49 other states that have to do exactly the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. The possibility for kind of sharing the solution, sharing the problem, it's a lot of foresight. It sounds like you guys are going about it just exactly the right way. That's great.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, this has been kind of a really lucky project to work on in the sense that the HHS team is very forward-thinking on this, and they just want to get it right. It's a high-profile project as well. There's going to be a lot of political scrutiny on it just because of the content of what the policy is. So it's really important to just do this right at all levels, including at the technology and including at the process, like you're talking about how this even is shared amongst other states.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, to me, when it starts to filter down to the states, the potential there is just amazing. On Gunnar's comment earlier about programmers running amok, we're talking very technical, and what is the viability of this? I mean, is this something that's just a one-time thing? Is it going to go away? What traction are you seeing or level of interest are you seeing in all of this?
So I think part of the reason this project came together is that when the Presidential Innovation Fellows Program started, I know you spoke with Ben Balter last week, who was previously one of the fellows and partly responsible for this. I think all or almost all of the projects that were being worked on were managed through Jekyll-based GitHub repositories. So they had blogs so the public could follow the innovation that they were actually producing, and it was all done using this method. So when a new project like this comes up, the people start to say within the government, well, what are the best practices? What's worked recently? They talk about the Innovation Fellows Program, and then they start hearing these stories about how, well, we stood up 10 websites, and it took 15 minutes of configuration, and then the rest was just working on content and design. Suddenly this starts to stick. It becomes very real. It also works really well because of the fact that, again, you're just generating static files, which is what people had designed systems in the 90s for hosting and for reviewing. So it's not a hard sell to say to a CIO, we want to serve the website just flat files. It's going to be the simplest way possible. But we're going to have this application that runs on an internal server or even our laptops or desktops that generates the content and produces those HTML files. I mean, it's really no different than if you were to use Microsoft Word and export HTML, except that you can do an entire site and the HTML isn't going to be atrocious.
Right. Well, great. So what's the timeline for all of this getting rolled out?
Yeah, so we just blogged about new designs for Pros. That'll be the first improvements will start happening in Pros probably in the next 2 weeks. We've got the Google Analytics Jekyll plugin that I mentioned. And actually a very simple build server that listens to an internal GitHub. Remember I mentioned you could take GitHub and bring it inside and use the enterprise version. We have a little server that listens to that and generates the site for you. It's a very simple application that you can run. And that will be open source probably in the next month. And then leading up to June, we want to have the entire repository for code open. So when we release the site, you have the public site, which most people will be interested in, and then the back-end code available publicly for those who have an interest in seeing it improve or just understanding how it works or reusing it for their own projects.
That's great.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Gunnar, do you have any other questions for Dave? I know you're excited. The whole state-level trickle-down open source is blowing your mind. You can barely contain yourself.
You know I love that stuff.
I know. And you're doing a good job of containing it. You're like, I can't believe it.
I think I want to congratulate Dave and Development Seed for a really exciting project. It sounds like you guys are doing great work and can't wait for June.
Yeah, thank you. We feel the same way. Like I said, we've got a great team here, and I'm really interested to see what the summer brings with new projects, for the government generally. I think shops in the government can learn how to do this on their own. And the maintenance is very simple, too. You know, we're able to kind of help people bootstrap and then unplug and just let them run with it. So it'd be really exciting to see where this goes.
That's great. So, Dave, if people want to learn more about all of the excellent work that Development Seed is doing, where should they go?
Yeah, it's just for us, check out developmentseed.org/blog. We've got it is a Jekyll site, by the way, so you'll see what one looks like. And you can search on there for some blog posts searching for Jekyll or CMS. We've written a lot about this, and we try to share as much information as we can just publicly.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Thank you both.